It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. We've got questions and answers and a little bit of security news, too. And we'll talk a little bit more about encryption, some interesting stories coming across the news, the security news desk. Security Now is up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 551, recorded Tuesday, March 15th, 2016. Your questions, Steve's answers, number 230. Security Now is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Enhance your technology aptitude. IT Pro TV is the resource to keep your IT skills up to date with engaging and informative video tutorials. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/securitynow and use the code SN30. And by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at freshbooks.com/securitynow. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover the latest security and privacy news with the explainer-in-chief, Stephen Tiberius Gibson. I crack myself up. Hi, Steve.
I'm so glad you're having fun over there, Leo.
Well, it's because I had such a good night's sleep, thanks to you. I must confess.
Yes.
Now, I went back to down. The elephant dose, by the way.
Good. Well, that's, you know, take what works.
Yeah. Well, it's nice. I mean, I'm just out. And then I looked at my, I wasn't using the Zeos forehead sleep tracker.
Right.
I had Fitbit on and I just let it, and it's the first time I should show you the graph. It's the first time I've ever had sleep where there was no, it was just like solid sleep. It was no waking moments, not even light sleep. It was just like a couple of tosses and turns at the beginning and boom.
Yeah, I've heard from some people who
I thought it was broken.
That remarked that they knew they slept well because when they woke up they were in exactly the same position as when they went to sleep. They hadn't gone to the other side of the bed or migrated or the covers were not ruffled, so
Lisa says, "You don't."
Anyway,
I
put a little note down in miscellaneous stuff for us
to bring this up. Steve Gibson's, what do you call it, miracle sleep formula.
Well, and your comment, I watched you on the new screensavers talking about it, and the FDA and my use of the term the healthy sleep formula.
Yes.
So anyway, we'll talk about that. We got a lot to cover. This is a Q&A episode, number 230.
Wow.
That is our 230th Q&A, but Security Now episode 551. And we're going to talk about, you know, I keep trying to think I guess I'm deluding myself to think that are ever going to be able to stop talking about this encryption debate, dispute, whatever it is. Because it's just not going away. So and a lot has happened in the last week. We expect
you to talk about it, of all people.
Right, right.
The other thing, and someday I'd love to know, if you think it's possible to make a smartphone that is truly secure regardless of government interference, like Black Phone or something, if that's possible even.
Well, the point you raised a couple of weeks ago was, I think, very salient, which is, one of the problems we have is that this is a very complex topic, and it's easy to get tunnel vision on one specific aspect, like, oh, how long is the key and how many, you know, how strong is a PBKDF algorithm so that it's 80 milliseconds per guess, blah, blah, blah. And then someone says, yeah, but if Apple installs a keystroke logger,
boom,
and it's like, yeah, all bets are off.
Boom.
So the point is,
even if you're using WhatsApp or Threema, right?
Correct. If you put something upstream of all of this unbreakable industrial strength, military grade, even the NSA, you know, they disapprove of it because they can't get into it. It doesn't matter if you capture their keystrokes or you record their microphone before it's encrypted, then it's all bypassed. So You know, it's just, it's, I think it's necessary. So, you know, the point you always raise when, for example, I talk about a given system that I'm enamored of, like Threema, for example, is, well, yes, but we have to trust them. What I think has come out of this, and I haven't seen this written anywhere or noted, is Apple is demonstrating the degree to which they're serious about defending our privacy. And, you know, if the FBI thought they were getting some PR benefit from encrypting their phones, then the FBI has just given them a massive shot of adrenaline and help by attacking them in this way, because, you know, you can't turn around. You know, I mean, the servers in restaurants are talking about it. So anyway, so yeah, we have there's some more interesting news, because now the government has responded in a footnote that just, it's just, I'm beginning to see red when I hear some of these things. But then there's also some news that's happened much sooner that was reported on the Hill publication yesterday about Dianne Feinstein and a senator from South Carolina. Anyway, we'll get to that. Of course, John Oliver has – that thing went viral from Sunday night.
We'll talk about it. He does his trademark talking about a subject, which he's done so well in the past. This time he talked about encryption.
And you know that I'm not – as I said to you, I'm not a big fan of his. John Stewart and Colbert, before Colbert switched over to CBS, they were – I loved them both there. John, I just never got it. I don't TiVo him, but I got so many tweets that I thought, okay, finally. So yesterday afternoon, I watched it all the way through. It's 18 minutes long. It is a masterpiece. And so I tweeted out to my followers in case they hadn't picked up on it. You got to see this. Also, I wanted to talk a little bit about David Pogue's comments on Twit, because he asked some really good questions. Yeah. And I blogged for the first time in, someone commented, since 2014 on this issue. We have a new IoT nightmare, a specific IoT threat, some news about Bleeping Computer getting sued, a new horrifying DDoS attack multiplying vector, some news that I know you've been covering about Windows 10. Pushing it even further and harder.
You're starting to win me over with your point of view on Windows 10. Well, I should say Microsoft's starting to win me over to your point of view.
Yeah. And then I do have a Windows update, follow-up, and some miscellaneous stuff. And then we're going to do 10 questions from our listeners.
Wow.
So, and they're great ones. So I think we've got a good, engaging podcast. And everyone, just grip the steering wheel firmly as you're driving, if you're listening to this while you're commuting, because you want to stay in the center of your lane if possible.
Stay in the lane. Now, someday the car will do that for you, but until then, you'll have to keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. But that's why we do these in audio as well as video. You can listen, continue to listen. A lot of you, I know, are IT professionals, want to keep your chops up. A lot of you also want to be in the field. You couldn't pick a better time to be in IT, right? If you're the guy who knows how the network runs, who are they going to call? So how do you get that job, you might ask? And how do I get better at my job? And how do I stay up with the latest technology? And my answer to all three questions is IT Pro TV, not only because it's great content, but because it's fun. It's engaging. And I have to say, you know, there's lots of ways to get this information. It's all on the web, frankly, and you could put yourself to sleep. Who needs Steve's healthy sleep formula? You've got lots of white papers to read. That's why IT Pro TV is great. You can put it on your Roku, on your laptop, on your tablet. You can watch it on Apple TV. They have an Apple TV app now. And have it running in the background if you want. And, man, you're going to just, you know, learn everything you need to know about any area of IT. All you have to do is visit itpro.tv/securitynow and take a look at the course library, and you'll get an idea of the depth of things covered by IT Pro TV in every area. CompTIA, of course, all the kind of the critical job certs like A+, Network+, Security+, Linux+, Cloud+, Microsoft certs, MTA, MCSA, MCSE, Cisco. They don't even do MCSE, do they still? Anyway, they've got classes in it, which is great. You can go back and learn Server 2012 or Project 2013 if you want. Office 365, Cisco, all the CCNA certs. I love the ISC squared certs on security. If you, I mean, really, let's pick a field that you're guaranteed employ. If you know security, man, you're the guy. They've got these great certified ethical hacker certs from the EC Council, too. And boy, their course, Sean Oriano Phillips teaches that 28 hours. And you're going to know everything there is. Everything there is. VMware, MS Office, technical skills, Active Directory in Azure, Amazon Web Services, antivirus, anti-malware. It's all in there. Even like building a PC. The best teachers, too, they really are engaging and fun. You can watch live, chat with them as they're talking. They do Q&A sessions. They just did their RSA coverage, and that would be a great thing. I hope that's still online. That was great. They interviewed like hundreds of people at RSA. It's all the big names. And their courses that they're doing this month include, the March classes include Microsoft Server 2016 MCSE and Microsoft System Center Configuration Manager. All the videos have full transcripts. You go right to the part you're looking at. And you get lots of extras like the Transcender Practice Exams. Those are $109 value, free with your subscription. They also, if you say, well, I don't have, how am I going to run Windows Server? How can I learn it? You could do it on a Chromebook. If you have an HTML5 compatible browser, their virtual machine labs let you set up, configure Windows Server, run clients, do the whole thing, make a mistake, blow it, doesn't matter. You just restart. You say, close the browser quick. It's which is actually what I do. Probably not what you're supposed to do, but it's good. Everything for a low monthly subscription cost, or you could buy a year, and then you can download anything and watch it offline. There, of course, is a no-hassle cancellation policy for two reasons. They're geeks, and that they hate it as much as we do when they bury the cancellation stuff way down there. So they don't do it. They make it very easy. But also because if all goes well and you watch the courses and you take the exams, you get the job, you might say, I'm done. I would say keep it going because nowadays keeping up on their business is so important. They have clients. They told me this. I don't know if I'm allowed to say it. The entire Harvard IT department now has IT Pro TV because Harvard said, you guys got to keep up on this stuff. The entire department. It's like 150 people taking classes there. itpro.tv/security now. Now, normally it's $57 a month, which I think is a great price. I mean, or if you buy a year, $570. That's a great price. But we're going to give you a special offer code, SN30, that takes 30% off forever. So now it's $399 for a year or $40 a month. Don't forget to mark your calendar. The CCNP security courses stream live. This is the first time ever, starting next Monday, March 21st. In fact, the free account lets you watch live. So if you just want to see what it looks like, you get set up a free account. You can watch live 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern. Starting on Monday, the CCNP courses, that's a great security cert. That's a really good thing to do. itpro.tv/security now. And don't forget the offer code SN30. 7 days free, 30% off forever. IT Pro TV. I love those guys, and they do a great job. Speaking of guys who do a great job explaining this stuff, there's nobody better than the security explainer-in-chief, Stephen Tiberius Gibson.
So I found for the picture of the week on the first page of the show notes is an interesting chart which Mozilla posted on their Twitter feed. They linked to it. They described it as bending the curve for HTTPS adoption, which has quadrupled since Let's Encrypt launched.
It's kind of amazing, isn't it?
It really is. Now, looking at it, there are a few things to note here. First of all, it's the rate of adoption which has quadrupled. They didn't make that clear, so it's not it didn't jump. The other thing that they did And I mean, I understand they had to, but it's one of my pet peeves is when you use non-zero based graphs.
Yep.
So this looks like it looks awesome. And then you look at it and wait a minute. On the y-axis, it goes from 37 to 42.5.
Yeah.
So it is vastly less dramatic. On the other hand, it doesn't change the fact that the ratio is 4:1. So in this case, it's okay because they're not lying through graphs. In fact, if they did use a zero-based graph, both lines would look almost horizontal, and it wouldn't be as clear that the second half at the Let's Encrypt launch point had quadrupled its rate of increase. So anyway, still, what they were seeing was before Let's Encrypt was, yes, sites were generally moseying along, slowly adding encryption over time, and that rate is 4 times what it was before. So a really nice data point, too, in addition to the fact that we know more than 1 million sites in we reported, and it must have been in the first, since it was near December, must have been the first 3 months, they got 1 million sites and a million certificates and 2.5 million domain names covered, because, of course, certs can have multiple domains in them.
One of our chatters, though, this is bad news, the David Johnson in our chat says, Apple's iTunes servers do not accept Let's Encrypt certificates. So his podcast isn't updating in the iTunes store.
That's odd, because they cross-signed them with a old school major CA. I don't remember now who it was.
He says they're using Java 6 for some of their components, so it must be a local client.
Yeah, problem. I think it's their fault. I wouldn't blame Let's Encrypt. So what must be is that all of us have a root CA, which includes the one that was cross-signing the Let's Encrypt certs, but this particular little weird client lacks that root. What I would do is I would update that client's root. You certainly want to keep that up to date. So there's a number of things about the whole encryption debate. Debacle. First up, I wanted to note that the legal rhetoric keeps escalating, and I'm a little disappointed in what I'm seeing coming back from the government. I mean, they've certainly not been light-handed in this. And in there was a 45-page DOJ filing responding to Apple's response to theirs. And in a footnote, they commented, let's see what I wrote here. I'll just quote myself. The latest filing in the legal war between the planet's most powerful government and its most valuable company, this actually was Reuters who wrote this, gave one indication of how the high-stakes confrontation could escalate even further. In what observers of the case called a carefully calibrated threat. And so this is where I'm objecting to the idea that the DOJ should be threatening Apple. A carefully calibrated threat. The U.S. Justice Department last week suggested that it would be willing to demand that Apple turn over the source code that underlies its products, as well as the so-called signing key that validates software as coming from Apple.
Hey, that's doing them a favor. We'll write it if it's too hard for you.
Precisely. Apple is saying, the All Writs Act is being overstepped because, we know that software is free speech, and the government has no right to compel us to write code on its behalf that we don't want to write, that we explicitly believe we should not write. And so the DOJ is saying, okay, fine, we'll write it, which means give us the source code, which we'll use to edit, and we'll, of course, need your super secret private signing key in order for that the software, the version of iOS that we write, the DOJ OS, to be accepted by the iPhones. So, I mean, this is just, it's becoming kind of silly.
Although, now, I remember China and India asking BlackBerry for the source code for the Exchange server so that they could write a backdoor for a BlackBerry Exchange server.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And we covered that years ago where BlackBerry I'm trying to remember the details. I think they wanted the servers to be relocated into their country, which would then give them access to the otherwise encrypted communications. And if the servers remained in Canada, where they were at the time, then they had no access because it was encrypted from point to point. But if it went through the BlackBerry servers, they believed that would give them some access. And I don't remember how that ended up.
Of them got it and some of them didn't. I think India got
yeah.
it and BlackBerry was able to successfully fight it elsewhere. You know, I think what's really become clear, though, is the government's long-term goal is to have all encryption have a backdoor, period. And if that requires rewriting firmware, so be it. I mean, that's really what they want, isn't it?
It's why I abandoned yeah. CryptoLink.
Yeah.
Remember, a couple
They're
years ago.
They're going to outlaw. I fully expect them to outlaw encryption that doesn't have a governmental backdoor in it.
And here's what's shocking is how quick this is going to happen,
yeah.
which is the story after the next one. I wanted to mention first that all of this Apple issue has been the data at rest question. That is, that the law enforcement handing Apple a phone and saying, we need to get into this, and here's a court order authorizing you to lawfully open this phone for us. Now, the other side of this is the data in flight question. And, you know, that's a whole different issue, but now WhatsApp is in the DOJ's crosshairs. The New York Times summed it up beautifully in just the first couple paragraphs of their story. They wrote, while the Justice Department wages a public fight with Apple over access to a locked iPhone, government officials are privately debating how to resolve a prolonged standoff with another technology company, WhatsApp, over access to its popular instant messaging application. No decision has been made, but a court fight with WhatsApp, the world's largest mobile messaging service, would open a new front in the Obama administration's dispute with Silicon Valley over encryption, security, and privacy. WhatsApp, which is owned by Facebook, allows customers to send messages and make phone calls over the internet. In the last year, the company has been adding encryption to those conversations, making it impossible for the Justice Department to read or eavesdrop, even with a judge's wiretap order. As recently as this past week, officials said, the Justice Department was discussing how to proceed in a continuing criminal investigation in which a federal judge had approved a wiretap, but investigators were stymied by WhatsApp's encryption. So this is all, like, you know, really pregnant. I mean, this is really coming to a head. And then I read just this morning on The Hill, they have sort of a week ahead summary. And the headline was, senators close to unveiling the Feinstein encryption bill. I know. Our
Senator
Dianne Feinstein. And I've watched her being interviewed, and I just get tense because she is so far out there in the no question whatsoever, nothing should be outside of the government reach side. And it's just like, okay, you know, calm down. Anyway, so she and North Carolina's Richard Burr they have legislation. It is written. And this week, it is expected to be put forth and unveiled. And then, of course, you know, this would be new law. Then I assume that both houses of Congress have to look at it and then reconcile it and come to an agreement. Then it goes to the president. And the question is, and, you know, based on his South by Southwest comments this weekend.
Well, we know he'll sign it. I think actually, you know what? I think it might be hard for Congress to pass a bill like this.
Oh, good.
I don't think it's going to get through Congress. I think Congress actually, there's enough people on both sides of the aisle who are against this kind of thing that I think this might be, I'm hopeful that, by the way, that's the last stand because we know the president will sign it.
Yeah.
So sad.
So, yeah, the Hill wrote, while some argue that a judge should order WhatsApp to help investigators obtain the information they need in a readable format, others are hesitant to escalate the dispute, given that some lawmakers are expected to introduce – oh, and this is about expected to introduce legislation to give law enforcement access to encrypted data as early as this week. Now, the good news is – I mean – you know, from a standpoint of like ripping the bandage off of the cut or the scab, I want to see what this legislation says. And I'm glad we don't have to wait 4 months or 6 months. I thought we were going to, but I guess this is like really ready. And I hope you're right, Leo. I guess my feeling is we had all the demonstrations from the academic and the crypto community. We've had testimony that was sane and coherent. And unfortunately, if the legislation says what it must say, all of that's been ignored. I mean, the fact that this is coming from Diane tells us that this is the government can. Well, I'll finish that thought. The government can decrypt whatever they want. Now, how do you implement that? I mean, we're all about details on this podcast. And, you know, as everyone knows, even if we do compel Apple to arrange to be able to comply with court orders, third-party apps, open source software, you know, existing crypto, which we've often said it's already left the dock. It's out of the barn. It's escaped. Everyone knows how to do that. So does it then become unlawful? Are you breaking the law if you use an encryption that isn't government approved? This thing opens such a huge can of worms. I don't even know where to start. So, as we mentioned at the top of the show, I've not been a fan of John Oliver. I don't know. His style just doesn't hook me. But he did, and it was aired on HBO Sunday night. So 2 nights ago. It's on YouTube. You can find it easily. There's a link in the show notes. And I think, in fact, if you just put John Oliver encryption, the first link, I'm sure, will in Google will take you to their property in YouTube. And it is even if you think you know everything about this, if you heard everything we've said on this podcast, it is a brilliant piece of work. And when I finished watching it, I found myself thinking, wow, they put a huge amount of effort into this. And there's also some fun at the end. So, you know, there is new stuff there, but really good coverage of this whole issue. And it's gone viral. Last time I looked, it had 1 million-plus views, and that was yesterday afternoon after a bunch of people had tweeted
3 million now.
How many?
3 million.
Good, good. Although I don't know if it matters, except we know that legislators care what their constituents think, and these are 3 million constituents who have to come away with a better understanding watching this than they had before. So
yeah, I think we're really seeing that Tim Cook's strategy was clear and was correct, which is to take it to the people, to create the conversation, and really, as best we can, educate people to the risks of a backdoor in encryption. And it is about backdoors ultimately now, because that's clearly what the end game is for the government. That's what the Burr-Feinstein bill is about and all.
Problem is, the term is ill-defined.
Yeah.
I don't like the term. So in my blog post at steve.grc.com, I wrote up a little essay on Saturday where the goal of the post was to separate the term, the idea of encryption from access. And what I the whole point was, one of the problems that this discussion is having is that everyone talks about weakening encryption and backdoors and using terms that are not well defined. The fact is, we have the technology to allow Apple to give the government secure access on a phone by phone basis in a secure fashion. I've talked about it for the last few weeks, the notion of a completely random key, which every iOS device has, which cannot be read from it, which is stored in the secure enclave, which Apple has encrypted under their ultra-galactically secret private key, so that even if their database escapes, then it doesn't do bad guys any good, because they still can't decrypt that database. The point is, encryption does give us the tools to do this securely if we wanted. And so the question is, do we want that? And but my point was, that needs to be a separate question, that we weaken the argument for not doing it if we say we're not doing it because we can't, because no one believes us, and they're right, because we can. So it's important to separate the technology, which can empower this, from do we want to? And I think that makes it a much more pure and correct argument. And that's why what David Pogue was asking was exactly this. You know, are we sure this isn't separable? And as I was listening to him on Sunday, I thought, well, I wrote about this the day before. You know, that's exactly right. The technology will do anything we want it to. That part is true. So it's wrong to say, and I think it weakens the argument to say, oh, you know, we don't think we can. No, we can. The question is, is that what we want? And so I think that moves the argument to exactly the right place. Let's separate the technology, separate this encryption and all that. We could do it securely if we wanted to, but Apple doesn't want to. That's the argument, I think, that we should have, is, you know, we don't want basically a spy state where the law is it's illegal to use strong encryption. I can't imagine being a citizen of that country, but, you know, it may be upon us.
Again, and that will, and we'll probably have this conversation at some point. Should, if encryption is made illegal, or, you know, real encryption is made illegal, because anything less is not real encryption. But if real encryption is made illegal in the United States, will we be able to get hardware platforms that support it? And kids, go to IT Pro TV, start learning security now, because I said this 10 years ago, and it's starting to get more true than ever. The future freedom fighters won't carry guns. They'll be hackers. They'll be coders. They'll know how technology works. That if you're going to fight for freedom, that's how you're going to do it.
Like the first scene of The Matrix, where the hackers are getting a little indescript disc from Neo,
right.
And it's like, this is all underground, super illegal stuff.
I can see a time when real encryption is illegal in the U.S.
Wow.
We've seen it before. It was classified as munitions in the 90s.
Yeah.
And we had a horrific consequence that we still suffer from.
Yep. I've been listening to you saying that, and you're exactly right. We've talked about it, how there's still 40-bit encryption lurking around, because once upon a time it was mandated, And we've seen how slowly this stuff drains from the technical ecosystem. You know, IoT devices, for example, many of them are never going to change after they come out of the factory. And, you know, they could have problems that will never get fixed. Well, they could have 40-bit encryption that'll never get updated. So it'll then, because it was originally weak, deliberately weakened when it was released. And, you know, maybe that's what it'll be. I mean, I can't wait to see this legislation. I'm so happy we don't have to wait very long for it because.
But we haven't seen the text of Burr Feinstein?
No. It's, as far as I know, it's not public yet. It's supposed to happen sometime this week.
Interesting. Yeah.
But boy, that'll be sad, Leo.
We'll see. I mean, I think the message.
Do we have to change the name of the podcast?
Insecurity.
To Security
now.
Was?
Security. Well, that's good. I like it. Security Was. I like it.
Security Was.
Yeah. That's good.
So, speaking of what Security Was, Brian Krebs covered a story that came out of the Talos team. Cisco created a group called Talos Intelligence. And these guys, the Cisco team, took a look at a Trane. Trane is a very well-known high-end HVAC, heating, ventilation, and air conditioning.
Oh, yeah. T-R-A-N-E. Yeah.
T-R-A-N-E. Exactly. But I think I had Trane equipment on my roof of the building I built years ago. Yeah, because it's high-end industrial, although this is a consumer product because it shows you photos of your family on the color LCD. Anyway, so I'll just share this real quickly. Brian wrote before, and I'm paraphrasing this, before purchasing an Internet of Things device, a thermostat, camera, or appliance made to be remotely accessed and or controlled over the Internet, consider whether you can realistically care for and feed the security needs of yet another IoT thing. In April 2014, so this is dated, although it took Trane a long time to respond, researchers at Cisco alerted HVAC vendor Trane about three separate critical vulnerabilities in their ComfortLink 2 line of internet-connected thermostats. These thermostats feature large color LCD screens and a busy box-based computer that connects directly to your wireless network, allowing the device to display not just the temperature in your home, but also personal photo collections, the local weather forecast, and live weather radar maps, among other things. Cisco researchers found that the ComfortLink devices allow attackers to gain remote access and also use these devices as a jumping-off point to access the rest of a user's network. And this is like the nightmare scenario. This is the worst as it could possibly be. Trane has not yet responded to requests for comment. One big problem is that the ComfortLink thermostats come with everyone sitting down, hold the steering wheel tightly and focus on the road. ComfortLink thermostats come with credentials that have hard-coded passwords, and by default, the accounts can be used to remotely log in to the system over SSH.
Well, that's comforting.
what a comforting link.
What a comfort.
And then the two other bugs that Cisco reported to Trane would allow attackers to, wait for it, install their own malicious software on these vulnerable Trane devices.
Oh, man.
And use those systems to maintain a persistent presence in the victim's local network. So the lesson here is, There cannot be any question but that we need an isolated Internet of Things network. It's unfortunate, but you cannot let this stuff which is going to have all kinds of bells and whistles and be reaching out to remote web servers, thus opening up ports through your router in order to be contacted. You cannot let that stuff touch your main network. We'd have to have isolation. And what I'm hoping, as I mentioned, is that the whole three router solution, while it's simple and clean and robust, I'm hoping it's a stopgap and that we will shortly have our standard consumer NAT router vendors offering explicitly offering network isolation for Internet of Things as a feature. That is, first of all, providing true isolation technology, not just saying it, but really doing it and making it easy to set up, where you simply, it should be easy. For the end user, it would be as easy as two different passwords, and you give your IoT things this password, you give your other network things that password, and by using different authentication, they are automatically on segmented networks that have no visibility of any kind to each other. Totally doable, just that easily. And we need that from router vendors or maybe from third-party firmware, alternative firmware sources. But boy, I thank Brian for bringing that Cisco research from their Talos group to our attention, because it's exactly typical, and this is tip of the iceberg. It's just the problem is that everybody wants to get in on this IoT phenomenon and have fun with it, and the problem is that security is not their focus. It's selling, putting things in bubble packs on J-hooks in stores and saying, oh, look, stick this in your refrigerator, screw this into your light bulb socket and so forth. And look at all the fancy things you can do. But security will just be a second thought. In the last week, something took me over to the Bleeping Computer site. We've referred to these guys often. They're neat guys. They were the early go-to site when ransomware first struck, and they have some online forums, and they had some good static remediation pages that talked about blocking the ransomware, detecting it, what to do about it. It's where we pointed people who wanted to spend more time digging into this. Something, I don't remember what it was, in the last week, took me there, and I got hit with a page covering pop-up that I didn't mind because it wasn't an ad. It was a plea. They apparently gave a negative review to something called Spy Hunter. And in retaliation, the Spy Hunter people have sued them. So what they're asking for is some financial assistance. If anyone has been using Bleeping Computer, likes the site, goes there, takes advantage of it, give them a few bucks to help them with their legal defense fees, because this is a lawsuit, basically frivolous, trying to force them to bring down a well-meaning, non-malicious but probably accurate review. I mean, these guys know what they're talking about, and it's unfortunate that whatever Spy Hunter is, didn't get glowing review. But Spy Hunter ought to spend their effort fixing their product rather than suing people who talk ill of them. So anyway, I wanted to give our viewers a heads up in case anyone hadn't been there recently, but wanted to give Bleeping Computer a hand, because it seems like the right thing to do. Boy, a new attack vector for DDoS amplification attacks. We've talked about DNS, how the problem with DNS and with NTP, the Network Time Protocol, is they're both meant to be very lightweight protocols. So they operate over UDP. You cannot spoof the source address if you want to use a TCP service, because part of what TCP does, the TCP protocol, is that the so-called three-way handshake. You send a SYN packet, short for synchronize, to the other guy. They send back a SYN ACK, which is basically a compound packet, their own SYN, their own synchronization, and an acknowledgement of the receipt of your SYN. Then you finally send an ACK, which acknowledges the receipt of their SYN ACK. So that three-way handshake establishes the connection. But that also inherently validates the IP. That is, both ends know that the IPs they have are accurate because they've just exchanged packets back and forth. So you can't spoof a TCP connection. If all you wanted in the old days was a SYN flood, you could send SYN packets off to a bunch of TCP servers and have them all send SYN ACKs back to the target of the SYN packet in a TCP reflection attack. That can be done, but UDP is different. The idea is it wants to be just a query and a response, very lightweight. Not all this set things up and get things synchronized and count the bytes and all that. No, it's just, here's my question. Let me have your answer. Perfect for DNS. Here's a domain name. Give me the IP. Bing, bing, done. Same thing for network time protocol. Very lightweight protocol. Well, there's another lightweight protocol. Nobody even thought that this was going to be a problem because there is no good reason for it to ever be public facing.
Which, of course, means it is.
Which, of course, means, right, Leo. And I don't know who is, and I'm curious if some listeners want to find out, I'd like to know who is, why are there 599,600, just shy of 600,000. It's got to be routers, and it's crazy. The protocol is known as TFTP, Trivial File Transfer Protocol.
Not SFTP, not FTP, TFTP.
Right. Now FTP is a file transfer protocol that we're all familiar with, or at least old school, you know, guys are. FTP is a TCP carried protocol, meaning in TCP fashion, you establish your communications and then you have a nice command set that allows you to say things like, you know, change to this directory, list the contents of this directory, and so forth. Oh, and you have to authenticate. You have to give it a username and password in order to say, this is who I am, in order to get access, you know, to log in to the FTP server. But there's a class of need which doesn't, by definition, require all that. And for example, it's when you have a old school router. I've got a Cisco router, for example, and I used TFTP, Trivial File Transfer Protocol, to update its firmware. I bought the thing off of eBay. It was in good shape, but I may not have even had firmware or didn't have what I wanted. So I found the right iOS. That's what Cisco's its internet operating system, iOS, is called. And I got a simple TFTP client for Windows and, you know, hooked them up by serial cable, I think, or I guess it must have been internet cable, Ethernet. But the point is that it is UDP. It is a simple packet and reply protocol. There is no authentication in trivial file transfer protocol, which again is how can there be 600,000 of these exposed to the internet when there's no authentication available? It's like, who's got their TFTP servers, 600,000 of them? Like, and they've, of course, been found by Shodan, and they're all there just saying, hi, ask and ye shall receive. So the trivial file transfer protocol is exposed. 600,000 of them are out there, and they can create, it is estimated, and in a research paper, which is behind a paywall at sciencedirect.com, so I was unable, and I didn't want to give them $40 for it. It wasn't that important. But the researchers developed a 60-factor bandwidth amplification with these TFTP servers.
60 making it, is not that bad, though, right? Or is it?
Well, it's up there. That's like right. That's up there with the best of them.
Is it?
Oh. So yeah. That's a substantial amplification. It uses well-known port 69. So somebody, probably Shodan, scanned all of the IPv4 space, sending UDP TFTP query packets to port 69. And got 599,600 replies, meaning that they have to be routers. I can't imagine. Maybe they're light bulbs. Who knows? But something is out there saying, would you like to update my firmware? Oh. I'd be happy to have some new firmware if you got any ideas. Oh.
I mean, I guess you'd have to figure out what it is before you could.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And the protocol doesn't require authentication. There's no list. I don't think you can list files of a directory. It is very lean. It was deliberately designed to be a minimal amount of code that you might stick in a ROM, for example, so that you could, you know, just enough. It's sort of like a bootstrap, just enough to then bootstrap the firmware so you could always count on the TFTP server being present. And then you would use it to then load the real firmware that you would then, you know, restart the device and up it would come with the firmware that this little TFTP server had allowed you to feed into it. Wow, it'd be interesting to see as this develops a little bit further what those 600,000 devices are, because while they're useful for a factor of 60 amplification attack, because again it's UDP, so you'd simply spoof the source IP with a query to it, and it bounces its reply at your victim. With a packet that is 60 times larger than the query you had to send out. So it must be a very small query and a very large response, obviously. I don't know the details, and I was unable. Unable. Yeah. Well, it's not what we want. Yeah. It's what the attackers are like drooling over. Although, frankly, if I were a bad guy, I'd be much more interested in what those 600,000 routers or whatever the things are.
Somebody attacked us the other day with a WordPress amplification DDoS. And it was a bunch of WordPress installs in Russia. Apparently, it has to do with the WordPress pingback routine.
Wow.
Yeah. It wasn't a very good DDoS. I know, I shouldn't laugh. It wasn't a very good DDoS, but that just shows you. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff out there.
Well, yeah, and that's the other thing, too. I mean, there are still protocol attacks. We've been talking about sort of attacks at the plumbing level, but ultimately a website wants to give you a page. That's what it's there for. And as we've talked in days past, if a website has a very high cost to delivering a page, then you can hurt the server by asking for pages faster than it's able to deliver them. That's not any kind of a filterable attack unless you have something for example, caching those pages in front of your server, which, of course, we talked about back when GRC was getting DDoSed. We talked about that was what Cloudflare was doing. So last week, I mentioned last week was Patch Tuesday, and it was happening just, of course, as Patch Tuesday does now during the podcast, and I hadn't had a chance to look at it closely. One of the things that got a lot of people upset was that in the guise of a security update, and this was KB313-9929, that also included KB314-6449. And the page for that 449 update reads, "This update adds functionality," get that, "functionality to Internet Explorer 11 on some computers that lets users learn about Windows 10 or start an upgrade to Windows 10, which, of course, we now know from the industry's massive backlash to this. I mean, people got a little over the top. I think it's just that people, as you said, Leo, at the top of the show, are just getting a little tired of Microsoft pushing Windows 10 as hard as they are. Woody Leonard, who's a well-known industry writer, he writes for InfoWorld now, he wrote, "Putting an ad generator inside a security patch crosses way over the line." Now, I wouldn't call that an ad generator. I mean, it's an ad probably only for Windows 10. But again,
I agree with Woody. It's way over the line. This is terrible.
Nobody doesn't know that Microsoft wants them to have Windows 10.
And because it's a critical security update, you can't not get this GWX ad.
Right.
So annoying.
And I haven't mentioned this, but I should. And that is that I've given people the link, my little Bitly shortcut, to what I have now proven is a bulletproof, perfect solution. And that's the bit.ly/no-gwx. That simply expands to the Microsoft-sanctioned way of saying no.
And does it work?
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
So you don't have to get the GWX control panel anymore. You just use this.
Nope. None of that.
They promise not to update on top of it and put it back.
Well, yes. But what I wanted to mention was my back was stiffened when I'm reading through the supported systems and I see Windows 2008 R2 server. It's like, whoa!
Yeah, you don't hold do that on. To a server. You don't do you that mean, to a server.
Yes, they do.
Oh, that's terrible.
And that's my point. Oh, that come it's un-effing believable that Microsoft would push Windows 10 to GRC's production server in any way.
Horrible.
It's just like I'm just speechless. It's like this is like, well, okay, there it is. I'm speechless. Although, on the funnier side, to go from this dark black topic, I got a tweet from Chris, whose handle on Twitter is self-untitled, and this just made me chuckle. He found a project on GitHub, which is the anti-adblock killer. And so what he tweeted was so perfect. He said, "The adblock arms race escalates again. An adblock blocker." Which, of course, this is. An adblock blocker. So this is the for sites that are trying to block your ad blocker, now GitHub is offering you the adblock blocker. I've had a number of people ask me about setting up Windows 10 machines. I shared my experience fighting with those laptops where the Windows 10 that came with Windows 7 SP1, Lord knows what happens if you just try Windows 7. It would really be out in the weeds. But even the Service Pack 1 is the final edition that Microsoft offers. And, of course, it's like 200-some security updates behind. But it's so old that they changed Windows Update after it in a way that causes it to get lost in the weeds. So I created a new Bitly link for people who want the basically Windows Update. And naturally, it's bit.ly/WUPUP. Windows Update, or Windows Up, WUPUP. That will always take you to the Microsoft Knowledge Base article titled How to Update the Windows Update Agent to the Latest Version. And you could also just Google Windows Update, and it'll also take you to the same page. That's how I got it from Microsoft. So,
a lot of people are complaining, and I've heard from a number of people that Windows 10 upgrade is just installing without permission. A lot of people are starting to report this. Now, remember, we talked that they've moved it to the recommended update.
Yes.
But we'd always said, and everybody had confirmed, and I'm going to have to ask Paul and Mary Jo about this. Oh, no, good. But don't worry, because, yes, it will download it. But before it completes, it'll say, now I have it. Would you want to upgrade, right?
I'm glad you mentioned it, because I've run across those stories in the last few days. It's literally, it is rebooting their computer and taking them to Windows 7 without their permission.
Windows 10, yeah. Yeah.
I'm sorry, to Windows 10 without, yes.
Yeah, and two people in our chat room, our studio, are saying it happened to them. It happened to you? Yep. Happened to them?
Oh.
That's a bug. I don't think that's what my...
Leo, is it a bug or is it a feature?
It's a bug. There's no way Microsoft wants that to happen.
Wow.
That's just bad.
Wow. Well, we know how badly... I mean, nothing could leave us to believe that they desperately don't want everyone to do that. I can't believe they're willing to do that to my server.
Yeah.
That sends chills down my spine.
Imagine if it upgraded without your permission.
Right. Who knows if my stuff's still going to work? Suddenly it just crashes and it's gone because it got Windows. What is it? Do they call it Windows 10 server?
No. It's like Windows Server 2016 or something like that. Or 2015.
Goodbye. Wow.
That is just unacceptable.
So I did want to mention to people who have been receiving the healthy sleep formula ingredients that I'm beginning to get feedback from people who are reporting the end of years of insomnia. So it's batting 1,000. Some people are succeeding adding taurine. For some people, it is actually stimulating and it hurts their sleep. Taurine itself is so good that they could easily just consume that bottle they purchased in the mornings and it would be good for them. I'm seeing a cessation of all of the ringing in my ears, the tinnitus that I have had.
What?
And it has some of that reported effect.
I have bad tinnitus, so if that happens, I'll be really... I'll send you a bottle of your favorite Burgundy right up.
Take extra in the morning, Leo, and see if... Taurine.
Taurine.
Yep.
Wow.
And I did hear you also during the pre-show of the new screensavers. You had an unsolicited discussion about the healthy sleep formula, and that it's continuing to work for you.
Loving it. Now, but this is what worries me. I kind of like, come to daddy. Come to daddy, sleep formula. I'm ready to go to bed. It's like, I love it. You got me hooked.
I know. It's just, you look forward to sleeping now.
I look forward to it.
Because it's just going to be a really nice night.
It's not the struggle it used to be. Yeah. We sound like we're doing an infomercial.
Well, the good news is it's free, and that's the point. The FDA has nothing to say about this because what they regulate is commerce.
Well, they've always been told that they can't regulate supplements, which was, of course, the Supplement Association of America or whatever getting the law changed. I think they should regulate supplements, but
it would be not. I as long as if it didn't increase the prices.
Well, it would. It would, and you decrease the availability. It would cause all sorts of problems. So it's probably but consult your physician before you do it.
I think it's
like
Orrin Hatch. Is he still alive?
Yeah, Oregon.
Yeah, I think Orrin has a huge amount of stock in the supplement industry, and so he blocks all the legislation that comes along.
Is that true?
Wow. So it's Orrin, you go, boy. Yeah. You just keep blocking any attempt
from
to
Utah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh well.
Anyway, so and I did want to mention, you also mentioned during the new screensavers pre-show that you were loving season 4.
Yes.
Of House of Cards.
Yes.
Now, I stopped after season 2 because I'd heard it wasn't any
good. 3 wasn't very good. 3 was disappointing.
Well, and I have to say, I guess they wrote it for me.
You have to watch season 3 before you can watch season 4. It's all
well. That's why. Yeah. That's why I started watching season 3. My point was, I love season 3.
Well, you'll love season 4.
Well, okay, because you know those first two seasons were like, you know, people were being asphyxiated with, you know, and it's like, okay, this just seems a little far fetched.
Yeah.
3 seems pure political machination.
It is. Oh, you're gonna love season 4. Oh man,
neat. Yeah. Neat. And I agree with you. Robin Wright is, but she's just acting herself.
Well, wait till you see season 4. She's in many ways now. That was probably what was wrong in a way for season 1 and 2 was you couldn't really understand what's her role in all of this.
Yeah, like, and their relationship was odd too. You know, they
get a lot more insight into it now. And
they would sort of sit in the windowsill and share a cigarette.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, what?
No, you know what? I'm now of the opinion that they had planned this whole arc all along.
Oh.
And this isn't like an afterthought. This explains a lot about 1.
Interesting.
Yeah, you'll like it.
Oh, I can't wait. Yeah. I'm like,
and I haven't finished
okay,
it yet.
Thank good for the healthy sleep formula because I need it. And I need to say that I continue to look forward every Monday night to The Magicians on Sci-Fi. I just like it. It's maybe they could pick up the pace a little bit, but I really am enjoying it. So for what it's worth. And I think question 7, it was a comment about someone in his... I think we might have had 2 questions about hard drives. So I thought, I'll wait to talk about SpinRite till then.
Well, I guess that's my cue.
That's your cue, buddy.
Let me do a little ad, and then we got questions for Mr. Gibson. But our show today brought to you by FreshBooks. I told the story on MacBreak Weekly. You can refer back to the FreshBooks ad on MacBreak Weekly if you want to go through it again. I don't want to tell the same story again, but it really was a lifesaver for me when I was a freelancer and I had to invoice. And it was a big pain point for me. And then Amber told me about FreshBooks. You've heard this story before, and it changed my life. And it could do the same for you because, and by the way, that was 10 years ago. It's gotten better and better and better and better. It is a super simple, it's, you know, really at this point, it's more of a full accounting system. And I tell you, as we come to tax time, people who are using FreshBooks are very happy because the reporting stuff makes it very easy to bring the things you need to your accountant, or if you're doing your own taxes, makes it so easy for you. By creating ridiculously simple cloud accounting software, they have everything you need to amp up your joy and turn down your stress during the tax season. Got a great mobile app. In fact, that new iPhone app. They're mobile on iPhone and Android, but they just released a new update to the iPhone app, and it's really great. You could take pictures of receipts and import them right in. You track time and hours. You can, if you're one of those people who does work in people's homes, you can create an estimate on your iPhone, get their approval, create the invoice on your iPhone without leaving. Get their payment through their payment dongle. You're done. And don't forget, of course, the best invoicing in the world. Makes it easy and fast, handles multiple currencies. And come tax time, you'll be so glad. It's too late for this year, right? Because tax time is now. But if you start now, then next year you can look back to yourself a year ago and say, thank you, myself a year ago, for doing FreshBooks. Try it free. Right now it's easy. Just go to FreshBooks.com/security now. 30-day free trial. If you send invoices, if you bill for expenses, if you, you know, or track business costs, all of this stuff, FreshBooks makes it so much easier. FreshBooks.com/security. Now, all we ask is that you mention Steve and Security Now in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Fresh, free, 30 days. FreshBooks.com/security now. A Q&A. Feels like, again, we went a long stretch with that one. I don't know why. Maybe we did. I can't remember. But I've got them for you. Did we do questions
just, we've been covering so much news, I think. I there's just so much going on right now.
So Dave Redekop was here a couple of weeks ago during the Security Now show, watching the show. Great guy. He was a sponsor years ago with Nerds on Site.
Yep.
We've always thought the world of him and his business. And he said, he wrote, I thought you and your audience would like to, this tip, stealthylinks.org. Sometimes, he says, it's useful to link to a bad site from a high-value site, but we don't want search engines to assume that the linked-to site is any good.
you know what he means?
Yeah, you don't give them any Google juice.
Exactly.
Now, Google has a way to do this, I should point out. But you have to have access to the HTML. You just rel equals, quote, no follow, end quote. And then it gets no Google juice. And that's what this guy's doing. So the site allows you to create a link that will bounce the user's browser through the site. See, this is the part I don't like. But it's different from a regular URL shortener in that it's purposely obfuscating the source and eliminating trackers en route. All the best from Green Canada. Thanks for the awesome podcast, as always, at DrTheNerd. So, yeah, very simple. In fact, a lot of software like WordPress and others will allow you to say, make my links no follow, but you can also do it by hand. And if you have no follow in there, then it goes straight to the site, but they get no Google juice from the site.
Could you post a no follow link on a social media site? I mean, and like add the no follow? I mean, you may not be able to control that.
I see what you're saying. Yeah. Okay. Okay, and I'm sure Bitly and others would let you do that. That's an interesting question. I'll have to Google that around. That's a good point, right? You're posting it into Twitter, but you don't want to give them any Google juice.
Well, or you just don't have, you know, like they may, all I can think of is sanitize. The word I was thinking sanctify. No,
Twitter
that's not
does
what I
no,
mean.
Twitter, I'm pretty sanitize. Sure, does rel no follow. I'm going to have to look this up. I'm pretty sure Twitter does rel no follow. This was a big deal.
They preemptively add that.
Yeah. This was a big deal because, and by the way, you're not giving them much social Google juice when you put something on Twitter or Facebook.
But I was going to say, so those are examples, but you know, just in general, like you know, putting a link in a blog a blog posting reply.
That's for sure what you would want to do in a blog. On the other hand, if you want to promote the site you're linking to, which mostly you do because you like it, don't put rel no follow in there. Facebook and Twitter have added no follow to the links. So you don't have to worry about Facebook and Twitter. They're not getting
any. So it's neutral.
It's neutral. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. More questions. Thank you, David. Let's get back to the Q&A.
Good luck with this location in Wisconsin. When I transcribed this, I thought, okay, Leo, you actually know where this is.
Everybody knows it's Oconomowoc. Michael in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. No, it's another crypto deprecation. I'm good at pronouncing things. As hard as I try to listen to every episode, I might be saying it wrong, by the way. I have no idea. If you say it with confidence.
That's right.
Oh, you mean Oconomowoc? Yeah. For all I know, it's pronounced Worcester. I don't know. As hard as I try to listen to every episode, a few slip by, and you may have already addressed this. I'm reading it exactly as written. Sick. Addresses this. I thought you and the community would like to know that the Payment Card Industry, or PCI Standards Group, has moved their target for TLS v 1.0 deprecation, speak of the devil, from June 2016 to June 2018. Quote, the Payment Card Industry Security Standard which is known as PCISSC, oh, I'm sorry, the Security Standards Council, is attending the migration completion, extending the migration completion date to 30 June 2018 for transitioning from SSL and TLS 1.0 to a secure version of TLS that is 1.1 or higher.
And I thought this was really interesting because it's the first that I had heard that we already had plans afoot to abandon TLS 1.0. It's like, wait, we just got here and we're leaving already. Because, of course, we have 1.1 and 1.2. And we, if we're learning anything, it's that it is just so difficult to get people to get off of the what's working, even though there's increasing evidence that it is insecure. People just still want to use what they've got. There was a dialogue with Ryan Sleavy, Google's Ryan Sleavy, over in the CA browser forum, with someone still arguing about SHA-1 and not being happy about being forced off of it for some reason. It's like, boy, you know, that that ship has sailed. You just have to. In fact, speaking of the devil, I'm now running Service Pack 3 of XP.
What?
I bit my own bullet over the weekend.
Welcome to 1992, Steve.
Exactly. I know. Ever since I updated GRC's certs on New Year's Eve, I have not been able to bring up GRC, my own site on my own machine under IE. I use IE because it's just so lightweight and it's just sort of there. It runs fine under Firefox and I don't even remember now Chrome, because I think it did on Chrome, because remember Chrome uses some of the native platform's security stuff. But what happened was that my squirrel client does use the built-in crypto in Windows, and squirrel wouldn't work. So I thought, well, that can't stand. So long ago, I had tried to install Service Pack 3, and it just sort of didn't like my system. And I always thought that it was probably because I had turned off a bunch of services that, you know, in me trying to run as lean as I can, I went through the service list and said, what is this? I don't need that. And turned it off and, you know, disabled it and disabled it and disabled it. And as a consequence, I think that's always why Service Pack 3 wasn't happy, but everything was working fine and I left it that way. But Service Pack 3 was when XP did add awareness of SHA 256 certs. So now Squirrel is running again and I can access my own site. from my desktop.
Nice.
So miracles never cease. However, we know that even TLS 1.0 or 0 is destined to be removed, but clearly summer, you know, the middle of this year, June 2016, that was never going to happen. And I don't know what the backstory is behind them punting 2 years, but that seems reasonable. I mean, there's no known problems with version 1.0, or we wouldn't be using it now. As far as we know, it's just fine. You know, we got away from SSL.
Doesn't it tie into Poodle? Like, can't you use a downgrade to get to SSH3 in Poodle? I think you can.
Next week, Father Robert and I are going to talk about Drown, DROWN, which is an interesting hack that does use access to an older version of SSL. Here we're just talking about TLS version 1.0. Although that is almost the same as SSL version 3.0. So, I'm glad that they're moving forward, and I'm glad that they're giving people enough time. So, yeah, it wasn't going to happen by summer. We've barely recovered from giving up SHA-1. That was that was enough of a workout for everyone. You know, and I'm finally back online, so I was like, okay, good. Let's leave things alone for a while.
What a wonderful thing. let's see. Wait a minute. Let me go back to the questions.
Scott
in Columbia, Maryland. He's wondering a little bit about encryption, the cloud, and Securitize. Steve, I have a question regarding exactly how secure it is to store encrypted information in the cloud. Well, you got to use P. I have a file. That's me, by the way, not Scott. Scott wouldn't say something like that. I have a file, obviously containing sensitive information, which is currently kept in a Veracrypt volume on a thumb drive. The Veracrypt volume was set up using the AES two-fish serpent algorithm, which, if I am reading the Veracrypt docs correctly, means the container is thrice encrypted.
Oh, yes.
And that's better than twice encrypted, which is almost as good as single encryption. The password for the Veracrypt container is a very long random string obtained from your perfect passwords page. Good. Password is, of course, stored in LastPass. You didn't think I could possibly remember that, did you? My question is, would it be safe, in your opinion, to store a copy of this Veracrypt container on a cloud service like OneDrive or Dropbox for backup of the very sensitive data, taxes, for example? Yeah, but just parenthetically, let me ask you, Steve, is it better to encrypt something three times than it is to encrypt it once?
Okay. So what struck me was the overkill of this.
Yeah.
Now, the argument, so what he's done is his data is encrypted with Serpent, mm-hmm. which is a good cipher. Then with Twofish, mm-hmm. which is a good cipher. Mm-hmm. Then that is encrypted with AES, mm-hmm. which is a, you know, the industry standard cipher.
Yeah.
The argument for multiple encryption is, and now maybe they each have different keys. He didn't specify, or whether they are using the same key. If they have different keys, then you end up with a key three times as long, which is like crazy long. But the argument for multiple encryption is, if a flaw were ever to be found in one of those, then your data is still secure. So that's the argument. However, standing back from this, he's got this thing triply encrypted and wants to know if it's secure to store it in the cloud. My take was the weakest link was LastPass.
Right.
Which is not to say that LastPass is weak, but the extent to which he's gone to protect this thing, which must be the crown jewels of existence, you know, and a crazy long, absolutely high entropy password that he got from GRC's Perfect Passwords page, you do not want to put it into LastPass. I love LastPass. I use LastPass. I recommend LastPass. But in terms of the weakest link, that's the weakest link.
And because why is that?
Well, because it's a browser. It's running JavaScript. You're depending upon nothing in your system ever. You're depending on your system never getting infected with something that had a way of worming its way into LastPass. I have no way of knowing if there is any way, but just from an analysis at 10,000 feet, the defect in his exquisitely overcompensatory encryption is he stored it in LastPass.
Yeah.
Because, which is not to say it's not secure, but of everything he's done, that's the weakness. And so I would by all means, I know that my pseudorandom generator is very secure, pseudorandom. No one has GRC's keys. That password went from me to him. No one could get it. I would use it, but then I would store it on a thumb drive and you know, put it somewhere else. Maybe and print it out. Because he doesn't have to remember it. It's not going to be that long. But if he absolutely had to type it in again, he could. But the thumb drive is more convenient. The printout is absolutely bulletproof against prevents against loss. But, you know, don't store it on your local computer in any form, even in LastPass, because that's the point of greatest vulnerability. So Scott asks, is it safe? Oh, my God, yes. Triple encryption with different algorithms. That's very safe.
JW, Washington State wonders about Jupyter in the web browser. I'm a chemical researcher and instructor. About half a year ago, I began using a tool called Jupyter. It's J-U-P-Y-T-E-R. Notebook. You find it at jupyter.org to assist my research and teaching. And I find it immensely useful. It allows me to generate documents containing code, documentation, graphics, and other elements to organize and share my work with students and other researchers. However, I'm slightly uncomfortable with the fact that the podcast runs in the web browser and connects to a server created by the Python kernel. If browser inter-tab sandboxing and my firewall prevent malicious access to my notebook and server, there should be no problem. However, the fact that I'm writing and executing Python code from the browser makes me uneasy. As an extra precaution, I'm thinking it would be nice to have a separate browser that does not connect to the internet that I can dedicate to Jupyter. Would this be an effective precaution, and how might this be accomplished? I don't see an easy way to configure a Mac firewall to block a specific browser. I'm also curious about what it means that the browser is connecting to a server on my system. Is this something I should be concerned about? Thanks to the great podcast, JW from Washington. I'm going to have to take a look at this Jupyter thing. I'm not sure what
you
it
should,
is.
Leo. I was unfamiliar with it before he mentioned it. And it's a very interesting system. It looks like it says it supports over 40 different languages. The server is written in Python. And it looks like you're actually able to author code in the browser that it then runs. So in order to like create animations and physical simulations, you know, and all kinds of stuff.
Wow, this is so really cool.
It really is.
So what are the security concerns here?
So what they've done is interesting. They wanted a cross-platform solution. So they implemented their system as a server running in the local system.
Localhost.
With a localhost, exactly, which you connect to with your browser. Now, it happens that I've just come out of several months of work with the Squirrel Group looking at the idea of the Squirrel client in a user's machine creating a local host server so that the browser could receive the session permission, essentially the session tag directly from the client rather than looping through the internet. Because that would, if it were feasible, would provide absolute man-in-the-middle protection. The problem is Microsoft is deprecating the use of local host servers. They're threatening not to allow it in their Edge browser. In fact, they for a while it was going to be turned off. Then before they shipped, they turned it back on. But they really seem to be making noise that they don't want to allow this in the future. So unfortunately, we developed the technology, we proved it, and we decided, okay, you know, the proper place to do this would be with a plugin. A plugin would have the same capability of establishing its own communication. We were just trying to do it in a browser neutral, plugin free way. But the point is, there is nothing insecure about this kind of communication. I also saw something in the last couple of weeks where some other security product was using the same thing. That is, they were setting up a server listening on 127.0.0.1, the so-called local host IP, and some other component of their system was talking to that server through the local host, which it makes people nervous because they sort of think of it as the internet. They think of it as IPs, and we know of all the scary things that can happen between IPs. But the way Windows and other operating systems implement this is it's basically inter-process communication. It is. Oh, I know what it was. It was something that was going around where there was this communication between processes that was not encrypted. And it was like, you know, shouldn't it be encrypted? It's like, well, it actually all occurs in the kernel. And while, yes, you could technically intercept if you modified the kernel and intercepted kernel level things, then you could intercept the communication between that local host server and the client that is accessing it. If you have that capability of being in the kernel, then all bets are off anyway. You could do anything you want to if you're able to, if you have that level of control over what's happening in the kernel. So I don't see anything wrong with this notion of something is running a server in the local machine, and then the browser you probably put into it, you know, http://127.0.0.1, you know, hit enter, and up, oh, maybe colon something, like,
yeah,
it may not
a port,
be running
8888.
On
8888.
Ah, right. So that's a common, you know, a fallback from the normal HTTP port 80. So colon 8888. And then it's going to be like, bing, now you're looking at a page generated by that local server. Now, his concern is, what about inter-tab isolation? And I agree with him that we are depending upon the browser not making any mistakes and keeping code in one page in a different from a different domain, like some, you know, malicious.org, separate from 127.0.0.1. I wasn't sure when I read this whether the same origin policy did incorporate a port, and it does. So, because if it didn't, then you could, some malicious person could set up 127.0.0.1 on a different port, and then have the same 127.0.0.1 IP, and then break inter-tab isolation. But same origin policy, as we would hope. These guys were on the ball. They include the port. So what that does is it prevents that attack. And same origin policy, which, again, remember, it is the first thing browsers do is prevent queries across origins, because that's the only thing that keeps tabs safe from each other and keeps them from playing any games with each other's cookies and so forth. So which is why that Chromodo browser, which didn't enforce same origin policy at all, just had the Google guys, you know, breathless with disbelief. It's like, you took our Chromium browser. First of all, you named it Chromodo. Thank you, not. And then you ruined its security.
Chromodo. Yeah.
Anyway, so I don't think Jay has anything to worry about. This is a very cool application. And it's sort of nifty that it – so the server being in Python means that it's portable. So it's probably – there's probably a version for Mac and Linux and Windows and anything. And then you just use any browser to communicate with it, a kind of a cool way of doing a very high-end sophisticated UI just using the browser rather than like a custom app.
Yeah. In fact, thank you for tipping me off. I'm downloading it now, installing it.
It's neat looking. Yeah.
It's a great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you don't have to have it on a local server. You could have it on a regular server.
You could.
And then you'd have your own web-based Python notebook or Rust or R or whatever else you wanted to use. That's a great.
Right.
Do you use it? You're nodding, but yeah, it's cool. Yeah, it's a really neat idea. Python folks are really amazing. Python is such a great community.
I had a very good friend who I've known since my early 20s, one of the sharpest developers I've known, who said to me a couple years ago, and he's been coding straight for 40 years. He said, "I have never been as productive as I have been in Python."
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah.
It's just you know,
it's lovely. It's lovely.
You know, Lord knows there's a bazillion languages out there. And when someone now says to me, what should I learn first? I say, yeah, take a look at Python. Yeah. The nice thing is that now the whole ecosystem is so huge and mature that you can get all the help you could ask for. Anything you want to know, you know, the net has it. Lots of tutorials, lots of references and information on site or online, and great O'Reilly books too.
And they use a Python called IPython, which is an interactive Python designed for, I think, for Jupyter. Scientists love Python because the science libraries, the math libraries are so phenomenal. Great language. Let's move on. Question number whatever here. Wait a minute. Let me find it.
Fine.
You know why? Because I started installing Jupyter. And I lost the questions here. Question five from Jim Murchison. Focus, I know. Mountain Ranch, California. He found a frightening SSL cert in his system store. Being one who checks his SSL certs every so often, I recently found an all-purposes cert in my certificate store from Appian Replay Media Catcher 6.
Oh.
That was essentially a man. Now, by the way, Replay Media, I know this program. It's a good, useful program. You can use it to record audio and video that you're streaming on the net that isn't intended to be recorded, and I suspect that's why they did it this way. It's essentially a man in the middle sitting on my own machine, much like certs from antivirus companies. Do you know of any tools that monitor cert stores and report when changes are made?
So... If I weren't so far behind, I would immediately whip out a utility. I'm not going
idea.
To.
Yeah,
it is a great
Somebody
idea.
Should write that,
and that's why I put this in our in this Q&A.
Yeah.
Remember that Mark Rusinovich just recently updated the sysinternals tool with so that with a command line it'll do that. Somebody could write a little Python. Front end to the sysinternals tool that is invoked by the scheduler or maybe just runs in the background and checks every day. If anyone does, make sure you send me a note and I will make you famous. I will tell everybody about it because that ought to exist. I think the idea of something keeping an eye on our root store for anything that comes in. Any changes, first of all, you could certainly do it that way, you know, so you manually audit it yourself, then say, okay, I want to be informed of anything that changes, or do what Mark did, which is obtain the official store from Microsoft and do a comparison. So you would be alerted to any additions to the differences. Because, for example, again, I'm sure that Appian Replay Media Catcher 6 is... got the best of intentions, but they also have an all-purposes cert, which makes it's a God certificate. It can do anything it wants to, and it's in your certificate store. So what that presumably means is that your system is now trusting anything signed by it, which means anyone could reverse engineer that application and produce certificates that your computer would trust even when it should not. And that's just not the way it's supposed to work. This is an abuse of, unfortunately, as you say, Leo, this may be the only way they had of doing what they needed to, but this is an abuse of the root store. We just don't want random companies dropping all-purposes certificates in that our system will then trust. This is not a good precedent. So again, if anyone out there is a coder, wants to come up with something that manages our cert stores, let me know if you've done that. And we will absolutely let everybody else know.
A couple of them that you might be interested in. Strengths mentions that there's a Firefox add-on called Certificate Patrol. I think we've mentioned that.
The problem with that is that Firefox has its own private store.
It's not the system store. It's patrolling
and Certificate Patrol has been around forever, by the way. It's a nice add-on, but it's not going to do the job for us.
Okay. Will SIG check the SysInternals tool? Will that check just the browser store, or will it go?
It checks the system store.
Okay.
And that's certainly what these guys, the reason they put it in the system store is they're trying to intercept the system's security.
Right. Yeah, and I think that what you're going to see is there are, if you install something, is that there are a lot of tools that need to do this as a way of doing something unusual. As in the case of Replay, it's, you know, it's saving a stream that's coming in from the browser that is marked not to save. You know,
right.
And so they have to kind of intercept it and download it. And I don't know if it's the only way to do it, but I can understand why they did it that way. CJ in Indiana wonders about the... Well, if you took that cert out, it would stop working, we should point out.
I should just mention it's not that I'm taking any absolutist position. It's just information.
Good to know.
This should not have come as a surprise to Jim. You know, he should have been informed by this thing that and gotten its permission before doing it.
Typical in the Mac world, though, because they don't. Oh, incidentally, we're going to put in a special certificate so we can intercept traffic.
So like, why is there a dialogue here? Okay. You know,
that's fine.
Get rid of these dialogues.
Whatever you're saying, just stop saying it and let me use the program. Yep. CJ in Indiana wonders about the necessity of user agents in browser headers. Steve, you've talked a lot about user agents being disclosed in the browser's request headers and how this can be used for fingerprinting and possibly to identify targets. How necessary is this information in the browser header? I feel like we'd be better off if the browser stopped advertising nearly the amount of information they do to every website we visit. Do you have recommendations on how to limit the information in the browser header? Thanks, CJ.
So, okay.
There's good reason to do this.
Yes, there's two parts. First of all, I don't really think it's a problem because, technically, maybe someone could fingerprint you based on the unique or not necessarily unique nature of the headers in your browser, but it seems unlikely. Even Panopticlick, which is all about auditing how common they are. When you go to Panopticlick and have them look at your browser, as it does, it'll say, "Oh, we've seen 33,426 different fingerprints, and your number 32,197. So the point is, you're not unique, Snowflake. You're one of a group. So first of all, I wouldn't get too worried about the fact that our browsers have all this junk that they're sending out as request headers. I do think some of it is superfluous. Once upon a time, before we were as standards-based as we are, there were servers that would look at the user agent and send something different depending upon which user agent it was. And I remember our screen resolution used to be sent, but that got deprecated some time ago because it just became irrelevant, or because JavaScript was now able to read that same information and do whatever it wanted to do. So the first part is I don't think it's that big an issue. Second is there are privacy plugins probably for any browser you've got. He didn't mention which browser he's using, so I didn't go do any digging. But I know for Chrome and for Firefox and probably for IE, there are add-ons specifically for obfuscating. There's some that even randomly change the user agent just so that every query you make comes out looking like something else. So if you wanted to play that kind of game, you definitely could find something for your browser that would strip things out that are not necessary or just change them on the fly just to throw off anybody who's trying to fingerprint your browser. But again, it's like, I just don't think it's a huge thing to worry about.
And there are many other data points they can use to fingerprint you. So
exactly that.
You know, take one out, they'll find another. Dan Eshelman in Washington, D.C., and probably listening right now from his secret lair in a five-sided building, has a question about SpinRite and smart drive data. Steve and Leo, first of all, thanks for an awesome podcast. My coworkers and I listen live from the office every Tuesday. Hello, Dan and coworkers. I have a question about SpinRite and smart drive data. My parents' four-year-old iMac is a bit slower than I would expect it to be, so I thought maybe there's some bad sectors on the drive. I tried a utility called Smart Mon Tools to take a look at the smart drive data. And from what I can tell, I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh. And from what I can, it's just smart drive is so dumb. And from what I can tell, the drive is operating normally. Are there any indicators in the smart data that mean it's time to spin right the drive?
Okay, so a couple things. I have a lot of experience with smart because spin right version 6, it was the first version to dynamically monitor the drive's smart data. And what I saw was that the health indication that smart surfaces is relatively short term. That is, if a drive is having problems, running SpinRite on it will depress the health
I'm so depressed.
Indication.
Oh, sorry.
Because the drive is having problems reading data. But a few hours later, that smart health indication will have recovered, meaning the drive has noticed, oh, a lot of time has gone by and I don't seem to be having any more problems, so I'm going to report that I'm feeling better now, which is one of the coolest things about the way SpinRite interacts with the smart data, because that smart health should not be depressible by SpinRite. So if it is, then it's because the act of asking the drive to do some work is reporting I'm having problems here. But unless you ask it to do work, it isn't having problems, because after all, what the drive, you know, work for the drive means reading and writing stuff. So first of all, looking at static smart data, it can, in some cases, show you a problem. That it certainly could be that something like the relocated sectors parameter is like really, really low. But here's the second part: is how do you know it's low for that drive? Because there are unfortunately no standards in the smart industry or in the smart spec. Back when this was created under mandate by Compaq, that had a lot of market clout back then, they forced the industry to implement smart. The industry didn't want to, so it did the worst job it possibly could in creating smart.
That's the real story right there.
Yes.
I didn't want to do it.
Yeah. They created the weakest, worst, most useless thing they could that would satisfy Compaq. They wanted some means of knowing what was going on in the drive, yet wouldn't disclose what was really going on in the drive. So A, you can use SpinRite, and after it's been going for a while, look at the smart page. And what I did is I take the deliberately understanding the way it works. I use the starting smart health parameters of whatever is published. And any decrease in those that occur, I show as red, because there shouldn't be any. But if SpinRite does manage to push some of the health down, it shows it very clearly as red appearing in the bar that tells you, okay, this drive is saying I'm working harder than I should. But absent that, the only thing you can do is compare it to an identical drive. So if you've got SmartMon tools but don't have SpinRite or can't run, for whatever reason, run SpinRite, but you do have an identical system with the same drive, compare the SmartMon tools output of both. If they're the same, then it's probably the case that you're not learning anything. But if they're very different, if one of them has much lower health parameters, then that's an indication, absent any dynamic work that you're asking from the drive, that this drive is actually in worse health than the one you compared it to. But again, got to be the same make and model of drive, because there's no standard. It's only the same make and model of two drives will be the same, but not any other manufacturer, and not even the same drive, not even other drive models from the same manufacturer. It's just completely, it's almost worthless, except that SpinRite, because it uses the smart delta, that is the change in smart data, that ends up being highly diagnostic.
Question 8, Rick Sagar in San Jose, California, wonders why he doesn't need Let's Encrypt on his blog. He's talking about the Let's Encrypt certs. Steve, I can't believe you said, quote, he's obviously pasting from Elaine's transcript. Well, yeah, I mean, it's a blog and nobody needs security there. Well, you're right. I don't need to protect the words of my blog, but as you have taught me in the past, and as also mentioned in this week's show, we need HTTPS to protect people visiting the blog from a person in the middle meddling. Example, Verizon super cookie injection of malicious script tags into the HTML. So keep up the good work. Glad I haven't heard anything about your DDoS this week. At Rick, R-I-K-S-A-G-A-R on the Twitter.
So this was interesting. That's apparently a quote. So let me put it in context, which it needs. What I was saying was, historically, if the barrier was high, that is, you had to purchase a multi-hundred-dollar every couple years certificate and figure out how to install it, maybe get a hosting provider to do it. And so in some cases, hosting providers, before we had SNI, server name indication, in our TLS connections, some hosting providers that were hosting many different websites on a single IP were unable to disambiguate certificates. So you couldn't, using SSL wasn't an option back then. But my point was, for all of those reasons, if the barrier to using it was high, on something like a blog that didn't have a high security need, it didn't happen. And it is happening now because the barrier to using HTTPS has just disappeared thanks to Let's Encrypt. So it wasn't that I was saying you don't need it. It's that historically, the sites that didn't need it that much didn't bother. And now everybody can, to the point where I just like no excuse not to at this point.
Although there is a not insignificant barrier in some cases because you have to install the certs. Getting a cert for free is nice, but you still have to modify. I mean, putting SS.
No. Let's Encrypt does that.
Oh, you don't have to do that.
Don't even have to do
that. You run that little script, right? Yeah.
Part of what Let's Encrypt does, it's just magic. It edits your config files for you. You just sort of say, go, baby. And it says, I'm already done.
Right.
And he's like, what? And then you say, log on with HTTPS. And it does. Yeah. I mean, they just, I think what we're going to see is it will just be built in the future.
I'm going to try it on my Minecraft server.
Cool. Do.
Yeah. I mean, the problem is it's not an Apache. It's not an HTTP server.
Ooh, what is it?
It's a Minecraft server.
So the Minecraft actually boots?
No, it's running on a Mac, and then you run the server software just as you would if you were running Apache. Let me think about this. Could you do it at the DNS server level? No, you have to do it on the server. See, that's the thing. It's not everybody's running Apache or IIS. I don't know. What does Let's Encrypt work with? Probably just Apache, right?
And Nginx.
And Nginx. Okay, well, that covers a lot of the waterfront.
It really does.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool. No, it's a probably there's no HTTPS for Minecraft servers. How about for Jupyter Pages? John in Montreal argued that Shamir, the S in RSA, well, and Rivest and Edelman, the R and the A, did not invent RSA. Or I think he's talking public key crypto. Right? The distinction goes to some British cryptologists who came up with the idea during World War II. It was only declassified and made public well after RSA published their idea.
And, you know, I just sort of wanted to take this moment to comment that it is not true that the RSA guys did not invent RSA or public key crypto. They did.
Yeah.
They just weren't first, but they did it without any knowledge of anyone having... of anyone else having done it. And so you know, I mean, this is an interesting area that that we've run into, because I sometimes hear people saying, oh, well, you know, they didn't invent that because somebody else did, or what often happens is two groups are doing this stuff at the same time with no cross communication, and they simultaneously invent, and then one publishes before the other. And to my way of thinking, that takes nothing away from the other group that independently invented something. So that, you know, the fact that some cryptographers in Britain may have come up with public key crypto in World War II, but it was always kept secret, in no way diminishes the fact that the RSA guys independently came up with the idea. I mean, you know, there are lots of smart people in the world.
And of course, okay, I shouldn't say this, but in hindsight, it's pretty obvious. But only in hindsight, right?
Because that's the best invention.
Yeah, right.
Oh my god!
Like, well, that makes
Velcro,
sense.
Right. Velcro, and a zipper.
Pretty obvious. Yeah.
You know, you could spend a lot of time staring at a zipper trying to figure out how that sucker works.
I mean, what's interesting about it, a lot of inventions would be hard to describe, but I think you can describe public key crypto very straightforwardly in a sentence, in a prose sentence.
Which is, and that is, I think that's what makes it so beautiful.
Yeah, it's elegant as hell.
Yes.
The idea,
you know, it's one of those head slappers. It's like oh, why didn't I think of that?
And it does make sense that anybody in crypto, going back for centuries almost, would be trying to find a solution to the symmetric key problem, which is that you have to have a key exchange for a symmetric key to work. I have to somehow get you the key so that I can send you a coded message. And that's a very big weakness, because if they're going to capture the courier with the key, and then they can read everything. So the idea that you could exchange messages with a publicly available encryption key.
Smoke signals up in the air. Everybody can see it.
Anybody can see it, but without the private key, it's useless.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. And you can see how the Nazis would have loved that instead of Enigma, which was, by the way, a symmetric key system.
Right.
And that's, in fact, you know, that it was the fact that it was symmetric was how it was decoded, was that Turing knew that these signals were going out every day, these radio signals, with the key. And if you could, so his task was to figure out what the key was. You know, how to decrypt the key that's being passed out. So, and once you get that, then, of course, every day you get a new key, and it's a symmetric key, so you can decrypt all the transmissions.
Well, in the case of Enigma, though, they did have the master codebook.
Oh, they had the codebook and the machine, yeah.
Yeah, and the book was what was captured.
And that was what you would use to decrypt the daily message.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But you had to find the right page.
Because it had the machine settings for that day.
Right.
Right.
Oh, I love it.
I just saw the movie again, by the way. It's just The Imitation Game is a great piece of
work.
It's
a great movie, although, again, historically really a disservice in many ways to Alan Turing. But
unfortunately.
At least it popularized that whole notion. You know, it's interesting how encryption and crypto has broken into the public consciousness in some ways. And there's that great book which the Code Breakers, by Kahn, which everybody should read. If you're interested in this, that and Stephen Levy has a great book on crypto. I think it's Stephen Levy called Cypher. I can't remember. But there's a couple of books that you can read and get pretty up on this. You're not going to be writing your own protocols, but
yeah, and you know, I'm not sure that there's a need for the general public to know more than they know, but the fact that everybody knows that Apple is fighting with the government, you know, that's a good thing for people to know.
I mean, to appreciate the math is out there, and that you can tell anybody if you're half decent coder, I mean half decent, you don't even have to know the XOR trick.
you don't have to be John McAfee.
You don't even have
Is that
to be
what
John McAfee. You could write an algorithm that would give you public key crypto, right? It's not complicated. I think, right?
You got to be kind of good.
You do? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
the key gen routines are tough. Okay, just check.
It's not something you just kind of want to.
Well, the seed is tricky, right? You have to
pull out of your backside.
Yeah. Okay. That's because I'm an eighth decent coder. I don't know. Finally, Bill Barnes writes from Charlotte, North Carolina. And we have to make it finally because in 2 minutes, the polls are going to close. And I know you want to rush to the CNN. Bill Barnes in Charlotte, North Carolina wonders about the best drive choice. Stephen, where is the sweet spot in spinning drives between reliability, cost, and capacity? Performance is not a priority. In my usage, the home file server, that makes sense, on a single 2 terabyte Western Digital Caviar Green, purchased in 2010. Critical fires are backed up locally and on Carbonite. Can I safely get a 2 to 3 terabyte or even 4 terabyte drive from the big box store to keep my data another 5 years? Would I get better reliability with Windows RAID 1 mirroring and a larger drive or spanning smaller drives? Blah, blah. Recognizing the value of GRC since Spinrite 2, user of Shields Up since it was in the 7 digits, faithful follower of Security Now since Episode 15, programs due to Security Now, Astaro, Homachi, Carbonite, TrueCrypt, LastPass, and more. Wishing for CryptoLink and Squirrel. Looking forward to you getting back to Spinrite 6, 1, and 7. This guy is a hardcore listener. So by the way, we've never talked about it, but somebody released Google SSD drive.
Yeah,
information on where that was interesting.
Really interesting.
I think you need to tell us what it means, though, because I
will.
Yeah.
To answer Bill's question, no single drive of any size, and I'm here to tell you, can be counted on.
You know, this is a man who knows.
I just built, as I had mentioned before, and my thumb's pointing at it, a monster machine using the Haswell chipset. In fact, I noticed, Leo, that your upcoming virtual reality box, you're using the X99 motherboard and probably the LG 2011 socket and so forth. I have the same RAM that you guys chose.
You're building it too. This is exciting.
The Vengeance, whatever it is, although I'm just using it as my workstation.
Corsair room, I think,
The Corsair. What I did, this motherboard has one of the M.2 slots, the super high-speed PCIe little tiny card slots. So I got a Samsung half a terabyte, the 512 gigabyte SSD. That's my main drive on the motherboard. Could not have a faster interface to the processor. The state of the art, the NVMe interface, screamingly fast. And two terabyte drives mirrored so here's my logic. First of all, I will never use all of the space on that big NVMe, on that big SSD, and I don't want to because I want to take advantage of its wear leveling to move the information around a mostly empty drive. So big things like media and you know, temporary big downloads and stuff, those go to the spinning media. because they're temporary and they're huge. The idea is this high speed drive will hardly 10% full, probably, given my history. I'm running on, I think, a 30 gig partition now in my system, and I'm fine. But the idea is by leaving it way empty, I'm allowing the wear leveling to have lots of unused space to move things around to, so that it automatically extends its life by the percentage of drive I'm not using. And then nightly, I will take an image of that and copy it to the mirror RAID. And I have two terabyte drives, just because I had them around. And they're mirrored, because mirroring is faster than RAID, because RAID requires that you have computation in order to do that the RAID XORing process. So mirroring is able to be faster than RAID, so I get better performance, and it's 100% redundant. It is, so if one drive dies, I've got the other one. The BIOS supported RAID configuration. I could select AHCI or RAID. I did. So the BIOS understands the RAID. Windows came up. It understood it. And so, that's the architecture I chose. For the main workhorse, a deliberately mostly empty, screamingly fast SSD, but nightly images of that drive to a pair of spinning drives that are mirrored. So, Bill, your answer is no single drive. You've got to have two. And, I mean, you just do. Because, even the best drive, can something catastrophic can happen. The board could fry itself. There could just be something wrong with that drive. So you get the mirroring is the least efficient, because you only get half of the total data storage of the two drives. In a RAID 5, the more drives you add, the more efficient it becomes. And at GRC, I'm running RAID 6. I have four SSDs in RAID 6, so any two of them can fail. None ever has, but I believe in redundancy, because I know I'm in the drive failure business, and I'm doing just fine.
There you go. I really like that tip on an SSD. How much capacity should you not use?
My feeling is you should have bulk storage for like media stuff. For example, I've got all of my all of our podcasts are sitting here available to me. I'm not even sure why. I ought to just spin them off to Blu-ray and archive them. But so the idea would be, I will use the SSD sparingly. It's my system drive. It's what boots. I want it to be screamingly fast, and I want to keep it mostly empty. And so apps get installed there. The working files get installed there. But, big blobs go to the spinning drive, and images of that every night go to the spinning drives, so that if it ever goes tits up, I'm able to pull it right back. I've got an image that's never more than a day old.
You mean bits up, right?
Bits up. That's what I meant.
Thank you.
Isn't that what I said?
Yeah, bits up. The bits are up. Steve Gibson is at GRC.com. That's his website. Go there to get all the stuff he talks about. Man, this guy's amazing. He's prolific. He's like Alexander Hamilton. He just scribble, scribble, scribble. But start with SpinRite, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. It's his bread and butter. You got to support the guy. And by the way, you got to have it. If you got a hard drive, you need SpinRite. You should also go there if you want the podcast, because he keeps a copy, including a unique copy, the 16 kilobit version, which no one should have to listen to. But if if you really want it, It's the smallest audio version of the show.
If you're counting every downloaded byte.
There's also a text transcript, which I would venture to guess is the smallest download of all. And Steve pays for those and it makes them available. That's really, really great. I thank you for doing that. We have audio and video at our site, twit.tv/SN for Security Now. And of course, you can get it in every podcatcher. It's one of the oldest podcasts in the world. How about that? One of the oldest podcasts in the world, folks. Because
we're a survivor. The other ones have died.
Yeah, right. Everybody else gave up.
Yeah, that's gone, and everybody else.
Wisely,
yep.
Dignation, yeah, wisely. They just all said, you know, this wasn't that good an idea. But we are gluttons for punishment, and we're going to be back next week. And next week, I'm not going to be here. I will have been run out the door to get to a flight to New York so I can see Hamilton next week.
Yep.
Spring break for me and Lisa and Michael, our child. And he's a lucky 13-year-old to get to see Hamilton, I got to tell you.
Very cool.
And I'm hopeful that I'll really turn him on to American history and all that. But Father's going to do a great job, and you guys are going to talk about drowning.
Drown, D-R-O-W-N. Okay. Yes, a new, really cool hack for breaching TLS communication, no matter, even if you've got 1.2. Turns out some guys found a way to get the private key out of that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, it'll all be there. And then if you want to ask questions, we'll probably do that in 2 weeks. grc.com/feedback is the feedback.
Yep.
Steve, thanks so much. We'll see you next week.
Always a pleasure, Leo. Thanks. Have a great trip.
He always waits for me to say on Security Now, but I didn't this time.
Security.